Everything is connected, is basically the message of what I'm trying to tell you. If you don't look after your gut, you can't have a healthy lung. If you don't look after your lung, you can't have a healthy gut. How you sleep, how you breathe, it's all important. You inhale about 100 million viruses a day. The lung has its own microbiome. So what we know is that snorers or people who have sleep apnea have a very different lung microbiome to those that don't. The nasal microbiome was probably quite a big determinant of your risk of getting conditions like COVID.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to Take a Deep Breath. My name is Mike Mayer. I'm a breathwork coach and instructor, and I also host a podcast all about breath and wellness. And today I've got the absolute pleasure of introducing Dr. James Kinross, who has just released a book called Dark Matter, The New Science of the Microbiome, a senior lecturer in colorectal surgery and a consultant surgeon at Imperial College London. His clinical interests is in the minimal invasive surgery for colorectal cancer and bowel disease. He'll explain things like, what is the biome? The gut. So we're going to talk about lung biome, nasal biome. So obviously, you know, being a breath geek here, hang on, there's a biome, there's a flora, there's a garden of bacteria and other things living in our nose. And if we disrupt them, that's affecting how we breathe. Fascinating. Same with the lungs. We talk about a lot of myths I've heard around, like, if fecal transplants, are they real? And if you put the fecal transplant of an obese person into a skinny person, what happens? And vice versa, because we've heard things. Babies, when they're born, I heard about cultures putting a little bit of poop in the mouth of the baby to help get the microbiome going. And a whole host of other things like this. What it really means to our health, why it's a problem. We're having an internal climate crisis at the moment. You know, the biome's the worst it's ever been. And it affects all aspects of our mental and physical health. So a really important and densely packed podcast. I'm going to go back and listen to this myself with a pen and paper. Just before we jump in and I introduce him, I have a completely free 7 essential breathing exercises PDF. The link is down below. Join the thousands of people that have already downloaded it. I've been yapping for way too long. Let's get stuck into the podcast. Thank you for being here. Here is Dr. James Kinross talking about the book Dark Matter, The New Science of the Microbiome. Here we go. Take it away. Cheers. Dr. James Kinross, welcome to the podcast. First of all, how are you doing?
I'm really, really well. So thank you so much for having me. It's a real treat to be with you.
Yeah, and I love talking about and thinking about poop and microbiomes. And so although most people here are here probably for some sort of breath work related thing, we are going to be talking about the breath and the lungs today, but we're going to be talking about anxiety, stress, and a whole host of other things. And I genuinely, last night I was like, I cannot wait to talk to this guy. So so thank you for the book. Thank you for all that you do, and let's get stuck in. So I would just maybe if you just give people a little bit of your background, like what got you to be in where you are today? Why did you choose this route down the medical route?
Well, that's a really great question, and I'll try and keep that as brief as I possibly can. So I'm a surgeon. I'm actually a colorectal surgeon. So I specialize in the treatment of bowel cancer. And I went to medical school, had a pretty classic sort of medical school education. And then about, I don't know, maybe 5 years into my training, I decided to do some research. And through nothing but pure chance, I suppose, I ended up doing my PhD in the gut microbiome. And we're going to talk a bit more about what that is. And then I basically became completely obsessed by it. So this was, I don't know, maybe 2005, I guess, so quite some time ago now. But I started to understand that this was perhaps important, not just for the disease that I treat, which is cancer. It's important for, well, it's almost everything, really. And so then I decided after I'd done my PhD to devote my time to research and trying to understand more broadly the functions of the microbiome in not just causing disease, but keeping us happy and healthy. But despite that, my career kind of progressed. So today you can still find me at Imperial College in London, where I still operate on people who have bowel cancer. And I have a research group there, and we, in my spare time, we try to understand how bugs maintain our health.
Well, so you're a busy man, for sure.
Well, yeah, I think everybody's really busy today, aren't they? I mean, it's just, and that's part of the problem, the way we live our lives at the moment. We're so connected that, you know, we're always on, we're never off. And I think that's probably something that we all experience.
Yeah. I've got some questions ready for you, and my head's also filling me up with more. So I'm just I'm scribbling stuff down on the paper if you see anything else. So could you just define for us, what is biome? Where does the word come from, and what does it really mean?
Well, a biome is a living ecosystem, and a microbiome is an ecosystem of microbes, so microbiota, so microscopic life forms that live together in a connected and codependent way. So a microbiome describes not just bacteria, and I think most people understand what a bacteria is, or think they do anyway, but it's all other types of microscopic life forms, so viruses, yeasts, parasites, nematodes, worms, things with mouths and get their own guts, and all of the other kind of microscopic life forms that we need to sustain ourselves, but also all of the things that they need to sustain themselves. And it's a microbiome is contained typically with a niche. So a niche can be an organ. So it might be the lung, the skin, our urinary genital tract. It might be our gut. And our gut is the biggest microbiome that we have. So it's the one that people most frequently understand and most frequently talk about. There's a second component to answering really what a microbiome is in terms of human health. So what a microbiome really means when I think about it is that there is a sort of evolutionary codependence. So what it means is that many of our organs have transitory populations of microbes. So we might get an infection, for example, you have a bug there for a little bit and it kind of goes away. But actually a microbiome is something that sustainably lives in that niche for a prolonged period of time and has a symbiotic relationship, which means that both the bug and the host benefit from that existence. And typically those relationships take quite a long time to build up, right? So they've been there for hundreds or thousands or millions of years. And the gut, again, tends to be the biggest microbiome that people really think about.
When did we first understand that there was a biome in our gut or not? But when was that first discovered?
So like all things in science and medicine, the microbiome is what I would call a rediscovery. So I think we've known for some time that there were microbes within us and that actually they might be kind of really important. So if you go back to the early 1900s, so one of the most kind of famous fathers of immunology, a guy called Ali Mechnikov, knew that the microbes within us were really important. And before that, we kind of knew that they were important. But I think what's happened since the mid-2000s, around 2004, 2005, the first, what we would call kind of proper modern microbiome science pieces of work were done and published. And those pieces of work were done because the tools that came out of the Human Genome Project were suddenly translated into studying microbial ecosystems, actually initially in soil. It wasn't in humans or in animals. And we started to apply those to studying ecology within us. And they suddenly just kind of blew the doors off. People were like, oh my gosh, this world is much more sophisticated, much more complex, and much more important than we previously understood. And it sort of became a bit like, it's a bit like an onion. Each layer you peel, you just keep finding more and more and more and more. And the layers of complexity suddenly started to come into kind of view. So it's, but my book is kind of called Dark Matter for that reason. It suddenly became, it's biology on that kind of epic scale. It's like looking into space and trying to understand these super interesting, super complex relationships at a microscopic level that we hadn't really understood. So the way one of my colleagues at Imperial calls it, he says, it's a bit like discovering an entirely new organ. So in the mid-2000s, we suddenly realized, in our guts at least, we had a completely new organ that we just didn't really understand. And now it's a kind of exciting space to work in because every week a paper comes out that kind of tells you something which you think, oh my God, that's how is that even true? You know, so it's a very, very dynamic area of science that's just every day we are discovering lots more about it that we just really hadn't imagined.
Incredible. I first heard of fecal transplants, which I'm sure we'll talk about a bit, back in about 2014 on the podcast, and it blew my mind. So can I just throw a couple of podcast bits at you that I've heard and tell me if there's any truth to this. In some cultures around the world, I think especially if there's a C-section, they will take a little bit of the mum's poop and put it in the baby's mouth. Have you ever heard about this?
Yes, that's kind of true, disturbingly, but it is true. So actually what they will quite commonly in the UK, actually, they'll take vaginal swabs and they'll smear them over the baby's mouth. Yeah, so that's true. And the rationale for that is, well, we can really get into the weeds of this because it's one of my favorite things to talk about. But in theory, modern medicine says is that we are sterile until the moment we are born. So what that means is that there are no microbes within us until the minute we come into the world. And of course, when you're delivered in one of two ways. You're either you're out the sunroof, yeah, and you're having a cesarean section, or you have a vaginal delivery. And the vaginal microbiome is a very, very important determinant of health for lots of reasons that we can get into, both for maternal health and for female health in general. But it's also very important for the health of the developing infant. And so when the baby is born, that's the first time they really come into contact with microbes. And that seems to be an important seeding event because that's, if you like, the Big Bang. That's the moment when life suddenly blooms within us. And then we start to breastfeed, you kind of have another super bloom of microbes. So there's this theory, we have epidemiological evidence that children born by cesarean section are at slightly higher risk of things like asthma, allergy, and they're at higher risk of obesity and these sorts of things. But it's kind of quite controversial, and it's controversial for a number of reasons. But one of the big ones is that there are quite a lot of confounders in that process. And one of the biggest confounders, by confounder, what I mean is something else that might be causally associated with a thing that we're interested in studying, which doesn't seem to be directly involved, is antibiotics. So if you're a child having a cesarean, sorry, if you're a mum having a cesarean section, you're quite likely to get antibiotics. And children born by cesarean sections might be being born, for example, because they're sleeping distress, or they're unwell, or it's an emergency, or, you know, these children might be being rushed into the world for reasons that are not entirely straightforward. And of course, then they might be more likely to get antibiotics down the line. So yes, the route of delivery that we come through into the world is very important in seeding a microbiome. But what may be more important is the destruction that then happens to that evolving microbiome in the very early phases of our life. So trying to unpick that is not straightforward, or at least not as straightforward as you might think.
How important is breastfeeding? And from what you've seen, how long should a child be breastfed?
Do you love breath work? Well, if you're as fanatical as I am about breathing, you already know that how we breathe affects how we think and feel. How cool is that? And so we can use certain breathing techniques to improve focus, lengthen concentration, lower blood pressure, reduce stress and anxiety, be more in a peak state, help us get a better night's sleep, and so many more things. The breath is truly incredible. And it's the reason I've dedicated my life to this beautiful modality and helping people learn to breathe better. Now, I typically work one-on-one with clients over a six-week period. And there's three pillars to my coaching. Accountability, you're with me on WhatsApp. I give you exercises based on all my knowledge, 6-7 years now, 100 podcasts with world's top experts. I really want to help you by saving you the time of having to go and read 50 books. Interview 100 people. I'll get that information to you quickly. And that information is condensed and it's in a learnable state. Now, the bad news is I'm already booked now until November this year. So I've got a couple of spaces left November, December. But the good news is I'm going to open up two slots for August/September. So the link is down below. If you feel like now is the time to have a go at working with me as a coach, I only take on a couple of clients. I always get beautiful transformations. I help people move towards their goals. So if this is resonating with you right now and you're thinking, oh, I'd like to reach out to Mike, the link is down there. The slots go really quick. So I can't wait to meet some of you on a discovery call. And let's see if my six-week breath coaching package is a good fit. And I look forward to seeing some of you soon. Back on with the Breathcast. Cheers.
So I always say, like, until they have teeth.
Okay.
So I think the answer to that is, I think probably requires a bit of context, because breastfeeding can be quite an emotive topic. Many women can't breastfeed. You know, they want to breastfeed, but they can't. It's painful. They have problems. And it can be, there can be a lot of emotional guilt surrounding breastfeeding. So I think if you're listening to this and you're about to have a baby, you just had a baby, you know, just don't feel guilty. You have to do always what's best for you and what's best for the baby. And many children around the world get infant formula. But breastfeeding is a critical event in the evolution and development of the microbiome. So what happens when you start to breastfeed is that breast milk has lots of lovely sugars within it called oligosaccharides. And actually, breast milk in itself is quite a sophisticated body fluid that we amazingly haven't really properly understood. I mean, we've got quite a good idea of what's in there, but there's a lot of unknowns. And anyway, this causes a super bloom. So when these sugars hit the gut, we think there's obviously transfer of microbes through the act of breastfeeding, because of course, children having skin-to-skin contact with their mothers when they do that. But there is a super bloom of bifidobacteria in the gut. So your kind of gut goes from zero to, you know, really, really profoundly populated. But they tend to be populated with a very particular type of bug, of course, because those bugs are only getting the sugars that come in breast milk. So what the gut doesn't have is diversity. So it doesn't have lots of different types of microbes. It just has a small number in very large abundance. So as babies get into the world and they begin to explore and their diet begins to change and they start to move on to solids and they start to explore the world and start to put everything in their mouths. You've got a seven-month-old, right? So you'll be in this phase and they're just like chucking everything in their mouths all the time. Then you start to get microbial diversity and the gut begins to evolve again. So it goes through these very specific phases in development. And what we know is that links into the development of other organs in quite important ways. So the brain being like one of the most interesting. So you asked the question, when should you stop? Well, I don't have a really good scientific answer for that, to be completely frank with you. And I'm not a pediatrician, but generally, the longer you can, the better, within moderation and within reason, because at some point these kids have got to move on and have a more diverse gut. So most parents will breastfeed for 6 to 9 months if they can, and that's great.
Yeah, thank you for putting that bit in at the start as well about some of the guilt associated, because my partner had a terrible time at the start, and there was a lot of tears, a lot of pain. And she somehow got through it because it was really important to her to do this. But it was like on the edge for a while, where it was like, we had to do 50-50 with the milks, and there was all that going on. And yeah, it got easier, but we're still there. His first two teeth have come through now, and we've got a dog. And I'm like, oh my god. And the other day he was like, he touched the dog and put his hand in his mouth, like, oh no, and he was fine. And like, I was like, you know, he's gonna get sick, but it seemed to be okay. So yeah, interesting. Well,
look, so we know that kids who have pets, you know, have different microbiomes. Actually, a good lick from a dog is probably quite a good thing. And one of the things about urban living and modern living is that we don't live with animals anymore, right? So we eat and consume a lot of animals, and that brings with it an entirely different set of problems. And the way that we farm and look after those animals has changed, and that's a different problem. But we're not connected in the same way that we were. And that's really, really important. So what we know is that children that grow up in large families, so with large networks of people around them, and people who grew up with lots of animals, have a much more diverse and stable microbiome when they hit later life. And one of the theories is that that's super important for influencing your risk of immune-mediated chronic disease later in life. So unless, kind of to put it in simpler terms, unless your immune system gets that broad education in early life, unless you're able to create a diverse collection of, the word I use is symbionts, so mutualistic microbes that have benefit to both parties, unless you can have a lovely broad collection of symbionts that are able to protect you from bad actors that might cause problems later in life, actually you're at higher risk of having these immune-mediated diseases like asthma, allergy, inflammatory bowel disease, rheumatoid arthritis, these sorts of things. And so there's a big movement to try and understand, well, okay, how do you, in a changing world where family sizes are getting smaller and actually we're becoming more disconnected, how do you try and maintain the diversity and health of the developing gut in those critical phases? So having a dog, great thing.
Yeah, fantastic. This one's a bit controversial, I think, more in America, but raw milk in adults. Have you come across this? Benefits? I know there's some risks associated with it as well. I tried it the other day. It was delicious, but I was terrified I was going to get typhoid at the same time. Yes. I was fine, but still, any thoughts on the raw milk?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I'm a medical doctor, so my advice has to be don't do it, because you're at high risk of tuberculosis and contracting all these kind of bad diseases. So for those of you who are listening and you're not too sure what it means, is that basically means you take out the pasteurizing step in milk. So whatever comes fresh out of the cow, basically. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, you know, I do have patients that, in fact, I can think of one very particularly, who swears that their gut was forever changed by drinking raw milk and thinks that it's had a real benefit. And I can sort of understand why it might, because, and the theory would be this, that there are more probiotic kind of strains within that mm-hmm. milk, you know, that is going to have a kind of secondary health effect. Mm-hmm. I think the problem with it is that you don't know what you're getting. It's kind of not quality assured. So if you get raw milk from one farm, it might be very different from a cow that's come from a different farm, and you're not protected because you don't know that there aren't bad actors in that milk that could cause you lots of harm. And the problem is that if you're drinking that raw milk because you're unwell or because you've got a health problem that you're trying to fix, there's a chance that it might make you worse, not better. Mm-hmm. So we're actually in our lab, we're trying to understand how milk, how breast milk specifically, and actually how formula feeds influence the evolution of the microbiome in that early phase, particularly in early life, where it's super, super important. But having kind of raw milk when you're an adult and you've got an adult gut, the implications might be a bit different and not so straightforward. So generally, my advice is don't have raw milk. But okay. As a kind of experimental concept, it's very interesting.
Interesting. So we'll talk, I'm sure, a little bit later about what we can do to influence our guts, but maybe raw milk sits on the side. I know there's some other things. Can you talk a little bit about fecal transplants, any of the history, you know? And in particular, I was fascinated that I heard that, and again, this might not be true, that if you get the fecal transplant of somebody that's obese, you're more likely to put weight on. If you get the fecal transplant of somebody skinnier, you see where I'm going with that. So anything you can share around all of that?
Yeah, sure. So the fact that everyone likes to wheel out when they talk about fecal transplant is that actually it's a pretty old practice. So for those of you that don't listen, who don't know what it is, fecal transplant is gross and it sounds exactly like, you know, that's what it says on the tin. You're taking poo from one person, putting it into another person. So fecal transplant was used by the Chinese 2000 years ago. They used to call it yellow soup, and they would give it to treat traveler's diarrhea or infective diarrhea. And actually, you know, there's a long-standing precedent of fecal transplant in the animal kingdom. So many animals, they're called coprophagic animals, so animals that basically eat poo, will do this for a large number of evolutionarily beneficial reasons. So my favorite one is the panda bear. So panda bear mums will give their developing infants their new pups poo to eat because it transfers E. coli and all the bugs that they need to help break down bamboo. So panda bears can't metabolize and eat bamboo without bugs. So there's a kind of important reason to have it. So fecal transplantation in humans became more mainstream in the 1950s. So in the United States, there was a physician out there that was trying to treat a superbug. And the superbug was called Clostridium difficile infection, which is actually a product of too much antibiotic use. So you when you take too many antibiotics, all your lovely commensals die away, and this particular spore-forming bug becomes overabundant, it can make you really sick. And the problem is giving more antibiotics is not that effective. So fecal transplantation was initially used in the 1950s to treat that, and it was amazingly successful and completely ignored by the medical community because it was just too gross to really truly contemplate. So it then kind of got picked up again in the early 2000s. There was a group in Holland that did another randomized controlled trial with FMT in patients with the same infection. And the trial was so successful that they had to stop it early because the patients that got the intervention did so much better. It wasn't ethical to keep going and risking harm in those patients that didn't get the FMT. So what we now know in the United Kingdom is that FMT is now approved and regulated by by NICE, so the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, who determine, you know, what medicines are good and what medicines are bad, what medicines we can prescribe and what medicines we can't. And if you get that infection in the NHS today, you can have a fecal transplant. But fecal transplant is also a really important experimental tool for understanding how the microbiome influences our health, right? So scientists have been using fecal transplantation for many years to use it as a model in animals to try and understand what the microbiome does. So the obesity experiments you're referring to, well, some of these early experiments, that I began talking about in the mid-2000s, so 2004, 2005. And those experiments were done in twins who were discordant for obesity. So one was thin and one was obese. And if you took the feces from these people and you put them into, you know, animal models, you could change the obesity phenotype in those animals. So if you took a lean mouse and you put the obese twin's feces into it, the mouse became obese. And then if you put the lean twins feces back into that obese mouse, it became lean again. So people were thinking, oh my gosh, this is kind of interesting. Maybe this explains why we're obese, or at least it's part of the reason that explains why we're obese. And we can talk about that in a bit. But maybe also that's a tool that we can have for explaining, for using as a treatment for obesity. So we also, at the same time as fecal transplants started to become more widely used in trials for lots of other chronic diseases, we noticed that some patients are suddenly complaining about becoming obese. So they were lean, they had the FNT, and they became obese, and vice versa. Some patients were obese and they were losing weight. And there are these super interesting case reports of people having really extraordinary reactions to FNT. So patients with alopecia universalis, so patients who've got no hair at all, their hair's just suddenly fallen out, well, suddenly the hair will grow back. And now FNT has been used in hundreds of trials all over the world as a potential treatment for chronic diseases that you wouldn't typically associate with the gut. So, for example, the treatment of addiction, the treatment of allergies, the treatment of depression or anxiety, the treatment of cancer, particularly in trying to improve how cancer drugs work. And we're involved in some of those trials. And it's being used in lots and lots of different ways. And it seems to have this kind of magic ability, but no one quite knows how it works because the microbiome is just so sophisticated and so complex that the mechanisms are just kind of multiple.
Incredible. And it's so fascinating. What an interesting world you live in, honestly.
Well, you live in it too. That's and we all do. And actually, that's the kind of key thing about the microbiome. It's one of the most important messages, is that the microbiome, it connects us to our environment.
Mm.
And so there's a bigger question here, which is why and how has our society got to a point where we are having to experiment with fecal transplantation? How did we get so sick that this became the only option?
Interesting.
And the reason, or my hypothesis is for that, and I'm not the only one that has that, there are other scientists around the world kind of who think similarly, is that effectively we're having an internal climate crisis. We have lost that connection between our internal biology and the environmental biology. Bugs literally connect us in that sense.
Mm.
And this sort of loss of our really important biodiverse ecosystems over a comparatively very short time frame, so literally over, you know, decades, is causing a terrible pandemic of chronic disease. And until we really understand that, we are not going to be able to meaningfully prevent these diseases. So for me, fecal transplantation is very, very interesting because it's a therapy for these chronic conditions where we don't have good treatments. And I'm really excited to leverage it to try and understand, actually, how do we prevent them from happening in the first place? Because that should be better for us all.
Internal climate crisis. Bloody hell. That's very, very powerful words you've just used there. There's a book, I interviewed a guy called Doran O'Lean. I don't know if you ever come across him. He did a Netflix show called Down to Earth with Zac Efron. He went around the world testing waters and earthing. And his book's just come out called Fatal Conveniences. And he has a podcast of the same name. And he'll take something. And my girlfriend says he's like the Grinch. He ruins everything. So at Christmas, he released a podcast about something called phthalates in plastics that have a link to, miscarriage. And so I was like, I can't get the Christmas trees out. I have to get a real Christmas tree now, you know, because these things are in there anyway. So my girlfriend was not very happy about that. But this book's fascinating. It talks about like Bluetooth, the thousands of chemicals that go into your couch and into your bed that you breathe in at night, EMFs, all this sort of stuff. So why is there an internal climate change going on? And any of those things I've just mentioned, do they fall into that at all? What's causing this?
So I'm going to try and give you a straightforward answer to that quite sophisticated question. Mm. So the reason that the microbiome is so important, in my opinion, is because it's the middleman or woman, depending on what, you know, and you think about these things, between our environment and our genome, right? So everything that we come into contact in our daily living, wherever you live in the world, basically will come into contact with a microbe at some point.
Mm.
And microbes have this very large set of tools for dealing with those environmental stimulants and will respond to them just like you and I kind of respond to them, right? So there's this idea that you kind of hear in the probiotic marketing world of good and bad bugs. There's no such thing as good and bad bugs. That's not how, you know, that's not how bugs work. But we should not anthropomorphize them, right? They don't make moral decisions about whether or not to cause us harm. There are pathogens that cause disease like COVID-19, right? And that there are symbionts or commensals that live within us. Some of those commensals can cause us harm, but the majority are there to protect us. And what we're doing is we're putting those commensals under a huge amount of stress. What we're doing is we are taking all of the things that they need to survive, like a balanced diet. We're assaulting them with antibiotics. We are, in some cases, overfeeding them, in some cases, starving them. We are not giving them the kind of nurturing environment that they need. And because they are also stressed, they're behaving badly, and that's causing us harm. So if we take you mentioned plastics, right? So let's take plastics. So plastics do unquestionably change the microbiome. If you take an animal like a mouse and you feed it tiny little polystyrene balls, it will change the microbiome within a couple of weeks. The microbiome will completely change. We know from other animal studies like sea turtles that consume large amounts of plastic that their microbiome completely changes. And we know, and we're studying at least, what happens in our gut with the consumption of plastic. Now, we eat about 5 grams of plastic a day. It's in the foods that we have. So like an apple probably has about 185,000 nanoparticles of plastic within it. And it's inevitable that that will change the microbiome. And that's because bugs will stick to those plastics because they create something called biofilms, and they will stick to it. And that might then cause more pathogenic behaviors of those microbes. But also the secondary changes when you change the landscape in the microbiome then change the immune system of the gut, and it's that that causes the harm. We also know that microbes are evolving to metabolize and break down plastic because plastic is absolutely everywhere. We're now living in something called the Pleistocene epoch. There's so much of it in every part of our environment that our bugs are having to co-evolve. And because bugs can share genes really, really quickly at a speed that like mammals and humans cannot, they can adapt these environments. So there was some quite famous work done, I think it was about 2016, 2018, in Osaka in Japan, where they started to go through plastic landfill sites, and they found now these microbes that produce the enzymes that break down plastic. So it might well be that those bugs are actually sharing those genes and they're working within us right now. We just don't know. We haven't done the science yet. It might be that actually we can engineer microbes to take care of that kind of plastic crisis. So basically, every kind of environmental driver that you will hear about online, on the internet, on the news every day, it's coming into contact with microbes in some way, either directly or indirectly. And therefore, the microbiome is really, really, really important.
Yeah, fascinating. Really, really fascinating. Yeah, because this whole plastics thing came to me recently. I was watching a couple of podcasts on it. I was like, Jesus, it's doing all sorts of harm
really
to
bad.
Us. It's really bad, yeah. And so my girlfriend's getting a bit like, because I come up here, talk to all wonderful people like you. I go back downstairs and go, right, we've got to stop doing this now. And this has to, and so we've stopped heating up foods in plastics now. Apparently that's like the biggest no-no, because it just leaches it anyway. There's a biohacking movement, I'm sure you've seen. There's all these biohacks doing stuff. One of the things that's quite popular at the minute is a coffee enema. Any thoughts on this?
Yeah, don't do it.
Okay.
I mean, I think, the microbiome is very, very interesting because it is super complex, and it seems to apparently explain many of the gaps that we have in modern medicine. So modern medicine, there's this theory of personalized healthcare. I don't know if you've heard of that, but personalized healthcare means, basically it means at a very superficial level, how do you get the right drug to the right person at the right time for the right reason? So the majority of drugs, actually medical drugs that we give, don't work in the majority of people. So we've got to change that. So one theory was, well, we can measure your genome and we can give drugs that are particularly designed to your genome. That doesn't work because of the microbiome, right? So the microbiome is so variable between people. So you and me probably share, you know, about 10% of the same microbes in our vast kind of ecosystem of bugs that go between us. And the one big piece of learning that we've had of microbiome science in the last 20 years is that there is massive inter-individual variation. So you and I just share very few of the same bugs. And that's very, very important when you're trying to understand how a drug works, for example. But it's also very important way of explaining why we all experience subtle variations in our risk of chronic diseases, particularly diseases of the immune system, and our response to various therapies. And it's a massive golden opportunity for biohacking. But it's also a massive opportunity for misuse and for misrepresentation, because quite often people with chronic health conditions like this are very vulnerable and they're desperate and they've been failed by modern medicine. They will do anything to try to hack the microbiome to make themselves better. And the problem with doing that is that there is a kind of law of unintended consequences, and we don't know whether sometimes actually you're making things worse, not better. So if you come back to fecal transplantation, for example, so with fecal transplantation, yeah, it's this amazing super therapy that we want to give, you know, to people who've got no other kind of hope in their chronic disease management. But actually, there's also an equal risk that we're causing harm with fecal transplantation, because if we hypothesize, for example, that bugs are really important in explaining some people's risk of getting a cancer, we don't know that we're not putting people onto a different trajectory where actually we're increasing their risk of a chronic disease state later in life. So the temptation is to kind of experiment with things like coffee enema. But what I absolutely can 100% tell you is that your gut has not evolved to have coffee put in at the bottom, right? So like it hasn't. And actually, the gut is a long tube, and the populations of microbes that you have along that tube are all interconnected. And what that means is that they kind of dine in a great big long banqueting hall table. Right. And the food starts at the top of the table and it all gets passed down the table. And all the leftover scraps and all the secondary goodies that those bugs produce all trickle downstream. And that's how the gut works. Okay. So it all happens in a great big connected way. So if you kind of bypass that quite important connected system just by, you know, funneling stuff in the bottom end, you're not necessarily changing the whole microbiome, and you're not necessarily changing the microbiome at the bit of the gut where you really need to change it. So actually, when you're trying to biohack the microbiome, you've got to have a slightly more holistic kind of approach to how you think about it. Now, if you've got a disease of the rectum or you've got a disease of the colon, maybe sometimes actually direct enema is the right way to go. So, for example, in fecal transplantation, we sometimes give that by an enema. So we put a camera into the bottom and we pass it straight into the colon. But actually, we are increasingly of the opinion in my group and other groups around the world that actually, if you really want to change the gut, you've kind of got to do it more holistically. And the small bowel has its own important microbiome as well. It's much lower abundance. There's much fewer microorganisms there. But you've got to think bigger picture.
You might have answered my next question. So are you tending now to do more fecal transplants by taking tablets versus going up the bottom? Or is it a bit of both that happens
there? Yeah, so that's... So one of the problems in interpreting microbiomes or fecal transplantation studies is that there's a huge variation in the way those studies are performed and also in the intervention itself. So in many of these studies, no two fecal transplants are the same, because they come from donors who are sometimes very different, and they don't always standardize or check for the kind of type of bugs that are within that poo. So there's this phenomenon of super donors. I don't know if you've heard of that. So there are some people whose poo is just like golden. Like it works amazingly well. And these poor people, you know, end up sitting on the loo all the time, just, you know, producing endospecimens. And it's not a very scalable model, because, you know, that one person's poo can't, you know, beat the whole world's population. So, and that's quite a controversial concept, because actually there must be a commonality. There must be some sort of common functions within these transplants. And there's also some interesting data that's coming out that actually the host bugs, so in the person receiving the transplant, their microbes are also very, very important in determining whether or not that fecal transplant is going to what is known as engraft. So whether those bugs that you give are actually going to stay growing within the gut once you give the fecal transplantation. And many patients actually require multiple doses of fecal transplant after they've had their initial treatment. So it's not just a one hit and you're done. Actually, those bugs are not designed to be there, and you've got to kind of really nurture them and to keep them sustained. So to come back to your kind of original question, there are a number of companies and commercial kind of operations out there at the moment who are trying to standardize and quality assure an FMT. So when you get it, you get the same thing absolutely every single time. And also to give it in a more palatable way. So you can now receive them in something called crap seals. So a crap seal is like a, it's like, so you basically freeze dry the fecal sample and it comes in a, like a big plastic tablet and you just eat the tablet and it's okay. And one of the reasons that we think that's quite a good thing to do is that it's a much safer way to give the FMT, because sometimes you have to put a plastic tube in the nose into the gut and then you give like a poo milkshake through it. And that's pretty gross. But there's a risk of doing that, of aspiration and causing harm. So a crap seal is a much easier way to do it, and it's a scalable way of doing it, and it's a more palatable way of doing it. But also you get those lovely bugs into your foregut, you get them into your small bowel, and we think that that's often quite where a lot of the magic happens.
Yeah. I heard that ibuprofen is like hand grenades in the gut. Is there any truth to that?
Yeah, there is actually. I mean, I spend a lot of my time telling my patients to stop taking ibuprofen. The problem with ibuprofen is that it's a really effective painkiller. So it works really, really well at treating pain. So taking it in low doses, you know, over short periods of time, if you're in pain, is not a bad thing. And I wouldn't want to take that away from people. But if you're relying on ibuprofen chronically, that's really, really bad for your gut. It interferes with the way that we make prostaglandins in the gut, and it causes inflammation in the gut. And that's very harmful. And what we're beginning to understand is that microbes are really, really important mediators of how these drugs work, but also your risk of having side effects of these drugs. So taking ibuprofen, you know, particularly when you're a bit older, when you're a bit more frail, it can have quite significant consequences. But even drugs like paracetamol. So like paracetamol is the most studied drug probably of all time. It's probably the most commonly taken drug. I mean, I've got it in my cupboard, but I'm sure you've got it in yours. Brilliant drug. But actually it's a really dangerous drug. Paracetamol kills you know, thousands of people each year in the US through inadvertent overdose. And you know, our hospitals are full of people who've had toxicity related to paracetamol. It causes hypertension, it increases your risk of lots of other aspects of cardiovascular disease if you take it too often. And bugs seem to be a really important descriptor in explaining why some people are so sensitive to its toxicity. So actually you can predict who's going to have a toxic side effect of paracetamol in animal models and in humans by measuring what the bugs are doing actually in urine. And the reason is that bugs in the gut soak up something called sulfur. So they soak up a sediment called sulfur. And sulfur is a really, really important component of the liver's method for detoxifying these medicines. So it doesn't have enough sulfur to basically detoxify the paracetamol, and that causes the harm. So a human bug drug interactions, right, are massively misunderstood and unknown. It's like every time you take a medicine, you're just dropping it into a black hole where actually the microbiome has not been properly considered in the development or trialing of that drug. And we don't know how the majority of drugs work with the microbiome. And that kind of frightens me as a physician. Like, so I got prescribed drugs every day, and I know that there will be a lot of variation in the way those patients will respond to those medicines. And we just have no measure of that variance because we don't measure the microbiome.
Wow. Activated charcoal, good, bad, indifferent?
I don't think it's bad. You know, for those of you that don't know what it does, so activated charcoal, basically, it's literally what it sounds like. It's kind of charcoal, but charcoal has an enormous surface area and it's super, super absorbent. So one of the reasons that people take it is it just, the theory is it just soaks up all of the kind of toxins and just kind of gets rid of them. But, you know, I don't think it necessarily causes harm, and it might give you temporary relief for some symptoms of things like IBS and these sorts of conditions. But you know, we don't routinely give it in clinical practice because we don't have a big evidence base to support it. That doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't work. There is this theory of bioremediance. I don't know if you've heard of bioremediance, but basically what it means is that when you take an FMT, one of the reasons that FMT might work, so fecal microbial transplantation, is that basically it just detoxifies everything in the gut that was there. It just soaks up all of the toxins that were causing your gut lots of harm, because suddenly you've got lots more capacity in your gut microbiome to deal with them, and it kind of gets rid of them. So charcoal's kind of like that. It just soaks up all of the toxins, and then you know they're gone, and then you feel a bit better. Problem is that you then have to sustainably reset the gut after you've done that if you're going to meaningfully change your risk of having those symptoms back again, right? So if you're just taking something like that, but you're not really thinking, well, okay, how do I more meaningfully and holistically reset my gut or my gut microbiome or whatever microbiome it is that you're interested in, you're not going to fix the problem. And I think that's probably the bigger message.
No, that's really important, isn't it? Like you say, you do one hit wonder and then expect everything to change, but actually what you do, that's really important. I listen to way too many podcasts, clearly, on gut and
stuff.
Sorry,
that's my phone. I must apologise.
Oh, no, don't worry. We've got that out. I heard from an anthropologist that apparently all of us, tapeworms and worms in the body were really, really common until they were discovered. And then they were like, we need to get rid of these worms. And so we took drugs to kill these worms. And then an autoimmune rise happened. And do you know anything about this phenomenon?
Yeah, I know a lot about that. Okay. So that's where to start with that. So there are a couple of, we'll deal with the kind of worm thing first, and then we'll take a step back, and then we'll think more broadly about the kind of theory around this topic. So 2 billion people around the world are endemically infested with worms and parasites, right? So a lot of people are, and they are so common that they could be considered to be a normal part of the microbiome. But there is no doubt that many of these worms cause a lot of harm. These parasites don't necessarily kill you in the process of infection, but they do cause malnourishment, and they disadvantage many people, particularly in lower middle income countries. And there are quite well-meaning and well-intended, you know, global programs to eradicate some of these more harmful bugs. But if you go to North America or if you go to more developed countries, actually some of the things that we think about as pathogens or parasites that are kind of worms or these sorts of, you know, tapeworm, pinworm, these sorts of things, that they're just so endemic in the gut, even in the developed world, that maybe actually you could also consider them to be a normal part. Now, what these sorts of parasites have done over the years is that they've learned to manipulate the gut's immune system so that they can coexist within the gut itself. So they're really good at dampening down the adaptive immune system so that they can have this symbiotic relationship, right? They can just kind of coexist. Now, worms have got like super sophisticated life cycles, and they've got these, there's lots of micro drama because they're always having sex, and it's all a bit of a hot mess. But to come back to the second point that you made, which is that, okay, as the systematic destruction of worms in our gut caused harm, you've got to think more broadly. So I would strongly argue that that is broadly correct, that theory, but actually it's not just worms. It's the broader microbiome. So it's actually bacteria. So the bigger problem has been the globalization and industrialization of antibiotic use and antibiotic consumption, and the systematic destruction of our ecology since the Second World War, because that's the moment that conventional antibiotics came into the common consciousness, and that's the moment that we started to pump them into our food and manufacturing processes, our farming processes, and then they became the panacea for all healthcare problems all over the world, right? So there are theories that explain why we have this rise in chronic immune conditions that you described about. So like 300 million people around the world now have asthma. We have half of Europe are going to have an allergic rhinitis or some form of allergy by 2050. We have a 7% per year rise in things like rheumatoid arthritis, inflammatory bowel disease is skyrocketing. We have problems in neurodevelopment. We have problems in neurodegeneration. All of these things are changing. So one of these theories that's driving that used to be called the gut hygiene hypothesis or the oral hygiene hypothesis, that our societies are getting cleaner. That was then generally sort of discounted because it didn't fully explain this variation. And then it was thought, oh, well, maybe microbes are kind of an important part of this story. So maybe it's the changing relationship with our microbes. There were a number of other hypotheses that came out in the community, the scientific community. So there was the good friends hypothesis. So you're just basically losing those good bacteria in your gut that are there to kind of educate the immune system. And the most sort of recent one was put forward by this guy called Martin Glaser in New York, who said, well, look, actually, there's a disappearing gut microbiome hypothesis. Actually, what it is, it's the transgenerational loss of these really important symbionts that's happened over a very short kind of time frame that's explaining that. And I kind of go with that. So then the question becomes, well, what's driving that? And then you get back to the kind of whole antibiotic thing. So, nematodes and cestodes and all these sorts of kind of really kind of awful worm things that kind of keep everyone awake at night, they're actually used as medical therapies. So we're now experimenting with medical therapies in conditions like inflammatory bowel disease, in multiple sclerosis, and these other conditions, because you can use them to manipulate the immune system in those immune-mediated conditions. So we're putting them back into people who have these chronic conditions. So I kind of mentioned climate crisis. You have, if you want to improve your gut and you want to improve your kind of your general health, you've got to think about it at that scale. It is an internal climate crisis, which means that it's as important when you think about how you go out and you help everyone else's gut community, everyone else's gut health in your community, if you really want to improve your own. It's one of those things that we can't fix purely on an individual basis. You've got to have a societal response to it. Quite a long-winded answer.
No, it's very interesting, isn't it? So I always think, like, what are people going to, you know, we look back at people from a couple of hundred years ago, go, oh my God, they were crazy. Look at all the things they're doing. I'm sure, like, in a couple of hundred years, when they've pieced a lot more of this together.
So I mean, it's very interesting you say that. So I've been thinking quite deeply about this. And, like, we've lived through the most amazing time in modern history, where if you go back to the 1900s, you were very likely to die from a pathogen. So the thing that was going to absolutely kill you was either pneumonia, tuberculosis, or probably a gastrointestinal infection. And through the kind of 1800s and 1900s, we had this complete transformation in our understanding of how pathogens cause disease. We had, you know, it wasn't just hand washing or antisepsis, or, you know, it was the creation and the understanding of antibiotics. Vaccinations came in and life expectancy changed dramatically. So now, if you live in a lovely country like we're lucky enough to, and like we're in the UK, or if you live in a developed country, actually, you're not likely to die from a pathogen. You're much more likely to die from a heart attack or a stroke or a chronic disease, which disables you. So the way I describe this is, we're living longer than at any time in history, but we're not living happier. And that's because we've changed from a medical approach or a societal approach was just to kill all pathogens at all costs, to where we've got to a point where actually we've started to cause harm to all of these other important organisms that live within us and around us, both not just in our guts, but in our, I'm talking about the planetary microbiome, that we so successfully destroyed it in our bid, in our kind of well-meaning, well-directed bid to kill pathogens, that we've gone the other way. And that now actually what we've got is a plague of chronic disease. So we've got, you know, 20% of our year 10 to our year 11 kids are kind of morbidly obese. We've got a massive global pandemic of obesity and cardiovascular disease risk. And the consequences of that are just, I can't begin to overstate. So, yeah, like, we have to rethink this. We can't apply 19th century medical logic to 21st century problems. It doesn't work anymore. We've got to change our language, and we've got to change the way that we think about it. And that means you've got to have, a model brings the microbiome in at some level. Like, it has to be brought in, it has to come into the mainstream. And that's really my biggest message, I think.
I'm keen to get into the bowel cancer in a second, but you took my brain to the kind of micro macro version of this. I was hearing somebody talk about biome of the soil of the planet recently, and how that's gone really down over the last, you know, couple of centuries, and it's been farmed and all the nutrients are being taken out. What connection there is with us? What have you seen anything there? Hey guys, I hope you're enjoying the Dark Matter conversation with Dr. James Kinross. I just wanted to remind you, if you can take 2 seconds to rate this podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or if you're with me here on YouTube and you can see me, if you could just leave us a comment and a thumbs up, that would be so appreciated. And think about how you found this podcast. If you could share this with a family member or friend or colleague or co-worker, we'd be eternally grateful because it helps grow this community. Okay, back on with Mr. Kinross. Cheers.
Well, it's a really important connection. So we have a microbiome, the planet has a microbiome. Mm. So microbial life forms cycle all of our fundamental elements through the planet all of the time. They regulate and control the levels of oxygen and CO2, nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur, and all of these things through very sophisticated cycles are being disrupted. And they're being disrupted by the same forces that cause global warming, right? So all of the things that you already know about. And of course, because you go out and you put your hands in the soil and you farm it, there's a kind of tangible, practical, kind of real world connection between the soil that you have. And that is absolutely true. But as you've also described, there's been a degradation of the soil microbiome over, again, a comparatively short period of time. So there are a number of startups all over the world now who are particularly targeting that, to try and create, a more robust soil microbiome so that releases our dependency on pesticides and more harmful agents to grow the foods that are critical for our survival. Now, of course, you have to remember that, there's been a lot of talk, among the sort of late press about the importance of things like yeast and fungi, right? Mm-hmm. At the moment, Burkinophil and the rest of it, right? So plants have these very, very sophisticated symbiotic relationships with these microbes that have completely co-evolved over time. So just like I've described that within us, the same thing happens with plants. And we just have very little understanding of the true depth of that relationship and its importance. So to me, that's a kind of really important part of this whole story.
You mentioned traveler's diarrhea a little while ago. So my girlfriend grew up in Poland. She came to the UK when she was 21, 22. I was brought up here. Kefir she had every day, sauerkraut. They even, Lush. Like her and her dad, even, you get the sauerkraut in the juice. They drink the juice. I tried it all. It's disgusting. So they've got all these different things that I don't do. When we went to Indonesia a couple of years ago, whenever I leave this continent and go elsewhere, I'm in the toilet for like 3, 4, 5 days.
Yeah.
She's fine. She can go anywhere in the world, eat anything. What's going on there? Is that something people like me can fix, or will we always have that like delicate kind of stomach, or could we do stuff to make that better? Because I've tried the kefirs and they haven't really helped, but sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, so the answer is you can 100% improve the resilience of your gut for when you travel. So what's interesting is that in my business, so patients will come and see me and they will have IBS or they have some chronic gut problem. And they will say, I went on holiday and it got better. Mm. And I don't know why. So sometimes the gut responds in a positive way and sometimes it responds in a negative way. And that's very interesting. And that comes back down to the conversation we've just had. That's because when you go abroad, your microbiome isn't just responding to the foods that you eat. Mm. It's responding to the microbes that you come into contact with in every component of that environment. So if you're going to a hot environment and you're going to a city, the microbes will be very different if you're going out, to holiday by a beach and you're going somewhere, or maybe you're going somewhere cold, right? Mm. So, and we know actually, just to diverge just for 1 second, so forgive this one
go for it.
Deviation, is that when we look at populations of people that migrate, so if you look at, there's some big studies looking at Hawaiian migrants, so Japanese migrants to Hawaii, and various other studies have replicated this finding around the world, is that migrants adopt the disease risk of their local population within one generation. So you, as soon as you go into that new environment, your microbiome begins to change, you begin exposed to these different environmental stresses, wherever it might be. So typically you'll come into, if you come to the UK, you'll go to a high fat westernized diet, and you'll perhaps start to live in a slightly more sedentary way, your social network will shrink and everything else will change, and then your risk of cancer goes up, your risk of all these other kind of chronic diseases change. So on a much shorter time scale, let's say you're planning to go on a holiday, well, what can you meaningfully do to stop yourself getting diarrhea? So the first thing that you, the way you want to think about this is that you want to improve the diversity of your gut. So what that means is that you've got more types of microbes that have got a bigger portfolio of tools to protect your gut from bad actors or pathogens that might come and harm it. But you also want to increase the abundances of microbes in your gut, so there's more of them and they're kind of more resilient. So first of all, just de-westernize your diet. So stop taking all of the junk food that you typically eat. Stop drinking sugary drinks. Stop eating kind of pre-prepared food. Stop eating foods from your app and actually make your own food. And try and really go for a high fiber diet. So eat 30 grams of fiber a day. That means, you know, you've got to give yourself some time to do that if you don't eat a lot of fiber. The average UK person eats around 12 to 15 grams of fiber a day. So you've got to slowly build that up. And then absolutely do put in these kind of fermented food products, right? So kimchi, whatever you want, sauerkraut, sourdough, whatever. But the trick with doing that is you've got to do it sustainably. So you can't just do it every now and then and think it's going to make a difference. It won't. You've got to do it every day and you've got to do it for weeks. So you've got to do it for at least 4 to 6 weeks. I often also tell my patients to take a probiotic. So again, if you're going to like a some classic, you know, traveler's diarrhea hotspot, you know, you're going to India or you're going to somewhere that has a really different environmental microbiome, then actually taking probiotic for a few weeks before you go is also not a bad thing. And if you're going to do it, take a multi-strain probiotic and, you know, get as high a dose as you possibly can, really. I can't tell you which probiotic to take because there's no evidence. Well, actually, that's not true. There's lots of evidence for probiotics in traveler's diarrhea and traveler's diarrhea therapy, but broadly, just take a multi-strain probiotic and that will absolutely help you.
And a prebiotic as well? I've heard that you should take both. Is that true?
So prebiotic, if you don't know what a prebiotic is typically a fiber that we as humans cannot absorb or digest, and microbes will do it on our behalf, and that it then has a particular health benefit. So you can buy prebiotic fiber that's over the counter in powders as a kind of a supplement, but you could, you know, there are prebiotic fibers in all of the natural fiber foods that we eat as well. So an example might be inulin. So prebiotic fibers basically will lead to a bloom or a growth in symbiotic strains in your gut when you take it, because you're giving them the lovely food that they love to eat. I take prebiotic fibers regularly. I think they're a really good way of getting a bit of diversity in your gut and improving your gut. But I think what you have to be a little bit careful of here is just taking everything all at once and just thinking that's going to magically make everything better, because it won't. So if you're going to do these things, you have to ask yourself, well, why am I doing them? And so what is my goal? What is my health objective? What am I trying to achieve? And number two is, how do I do this systematically? So I know what component of my diet is actually having the health benefit. And the reason I say that, it comes back down to the point that we had at the top of this chat, which is that your gut is different to my gut. The bugs that are in your gut are not the same as what's in mine. And if you and I have inulin, it might have similarity of effect. So we might see blooms of particular types of bifida strains or whatever in our gut. But actually, there might be some variants there that's quite important. And we have no predictive measure of that. So I can't do a test in you to say, okay, you know, you definitely need this dose or you definitely need this amount. So what I typically say to my patients is, look, start this in a really systematic approach. Moving to a high fiber plant-based diet is really super valuable and the most important thing you can do. Do that and then introduce some fermented foods. And if you're still not getting the health effects that you want, or they're making you worse, or you're feeling bloated, stop. But you've got to do it for enough time. You've got to, you know, sometimes patients need 8 and sometimes 12 weeks of doing that to really have that health benefit. And that's because your gut has got to adapt to these changes, right? And then if it's still not working, well, you've got two choices. You either stop it and you can try and add in something else. And then you kind of just go in a kind of really targeted way. And many of these probiotic companies do not behave well, because what they do is they lock you into very expensive subscription models that just keep you going. And many of my patients are just taking this really expensive stuff and it's actually not helping them. You say to them, well, do you feel better? And they're like, no. And I'm like, well, why are you taking it? Stop taking it. So I just think, yeah, do those things that I totally swear by fiber and prebiotics and probiotics, but just do them in a kind of, in a more focused way is my advice.
Okay. Efficacy of home poop test kits versus like what you do clinically, anything there?
Oh, that's just a brilliant question. I think we need a whole second podcast on that.
Okay.
But I'll give you the short answer.
Yeah.
So the short answer is they have some value in very select examples, but generally they're a waste of money. So many patients come and they will sit in my clinic and go, they will come in with like a stack of papers and they'll go, boom, what does this mean? And I will say to them, I don't know. I don't know what it means. And I spend my whole life studying the microbiome. And the reason it's problematic is because, first of all, these tests all use subtly different sequencing techniques and subtly different sequencing methodologies. They all use subtly different computational ways of interpreting that data. So they all use different models. And none of these things are standardized. And thirdly, they are all based on associations between some species of bacteria going up and some going down, or some network changes in microbes and symptoms, or perhaps risk of disease is usually what they say, right? And very often there's no causal link there, there's no mechanistic link there, and they can't really say anything with any real certainty. And then quite often they give you the same common sense advice at the end of it that I've just given you, right? So you're paying quite a lot of money in a cost of living crisis for information that isn't necessarily particularly of value. Now, having said those things, actually, we really need tests of the microbiome that allow you to target the therapies that we've just discussed and to do that in a very focused way. But to do that, what we've got to have is standardization, quality assurance, and some proper evidence that actually these are cost-effective ways of making those changes. So what you're seeing is steps to do that now, both nationally and internationally, so that actually we can make sure that the consumer is protected and they're getting real, cost, they're getting, proper quality assurance in the tests that they are doing. So, I can't be too hypocritical because I do use microbiome testing in my clinical practice, but typically I use it where, for example, I'm making an intervention. So I either want to target it or try and give some rationale for the particular strategy that I'm using, or I want to understand very specific populations that are changing, that are going up or down, or I want to measure the effect of the intervention that I have made. So microbiome testing is very useful if you do it in a longitudinal way and you've got a very focused question that you really need to know the answer to. I suppose the final thing to say about those tests is that they're only testing a small part of the microbiome. So they're only telling you about bacteria. They're not telling you about archaea. They're not telling you about viruses. They're not telling you about yeast. Some of them might. Some give you parasite screens, I suppose. But generally, they're not giving you the global view, a proper, deep global view of what's happening in the microbiome. And they're all using different sampling techniques. So how you poo on the stick and a bit of the poo that you test makes a difference.
Wow.
Because if you, without wishing to be too graphic, right? If you, imagine a solid poo, the bugs that are on the outside are not the same as the bugs that are on the inside. So unless you've got a homogenized way of sampling the poo, and also, to come back to our conversation at the beginning, the bugs that are in the poo may not be the bugs that, or the absence of the bugs in the poo may not be the problem. It might be kind of higher upstream, right? It might be in your small bowel and actually not necessarily getting a measure of it. So there's been a rush into the consumer market with lots of companies selling these tests and, making lots of promises. And I remain quite skeptical of most of them. But microbiome testing, definitely the future. We need it. And we just need to be better at it. And we need to provide much better value for the consumer having these tests.
Yeah, I've had a resistance to doing them because they are quite expensive, and I've got a few friends that have done them, and they have all had the same thing. They got some data, and the outcome was have some kimchi, have some kefir, have some prebiotics, and I was like, okay, so I wonder what they'll tell me to do. Thank you. That was a really good answer.
So I think, one of the most important things about the microbiome is it allows us to personalize our diet. So this idea. There's variation between microbes, and that explains why you and I might have different nutritional responses to particular diets. Very, very important. So if you're trying to treat a disease like malnutrition, obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, let's do that science. And let's really focus on a clinical endpoint where we can demonstrate value and health benefit. But as a population solution in a cost of living crisis, how can that be the answer? It's not. You can't have people spending 400 quid on a test when actually we know very well what we need to tell these people to be healthier, right? Which is all the same standard advice that you've probably given on this show loads of times and that lots of other people know. which is to basically de-Westernize your diet. Mm. The value of the microbiome is that it explains why, if you do that, it has a health benefit. Yeah. It explains why, if you take the crap out of your food, you're going to be healthier. The microbiome is just a key part of that. So you can use the microbiome as another tool to say, look, this is another critical reason why you should do that.
Yes.
You're not going to get those diseases. And if you do, the drugs are going to work better. You're going to live longer and you're going to be happier, right? So, for me, that's the value here. Let's have a sensible, pragmatic conversation where we acknowledge as much of what we know as what we don't know. And we don't know a lot about microbiome. Like, we've only discovered this new organ 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Let's not overhype it, because if you overhype it, what happens is that people mistrust it. Mm-hmm. And then you're in a much worse position where actually people won't engage with you to have these kind of conversations. So, I'm the biggest microbiome evangelist in the world. Like, I just, that's my whole life's work, right? But we have to at the same time acknowledge there are things that we just don't know.
Yeah, really. But are you all right if we run till 5:30 still?
Yeah, fine with me, right? Yeah.
Because I'm conscious, we've gone so deep in so many areas and there's still so much I wanted to cover off. Thank you. That's really good, though. That was really useful. Where is the best microbiome populations? And is there any link to blue zones with what you've seen?
So for those of you that don't know, blue zones came out of a book that was written by a US journalist who went around trying to identify people that live for a very, very long time. So these were centenarians, people that live over the age of 100. And he was trying to understand, I forget his name. I'm sure someone in the internet sphere will remind me. I can't remember. I do know his name. It'll come back to me. But he was trying to identify things in their lifestyle that perhaps explain why these people kind of live longer. So the answer is that lots of studies have actually been done in the aging microbiome. So trying to understand how microbes influence our risk of not just living a long life, but living a happy life with a good quality of life.
Mm.
And there are two broad theories as to how these bugs might be kind of influencing those processes. The first is through a process of what is known as inflammaging. So if you've got an immune system that is kind of uncontrolled and unregulated and causing more damage to you as a person, then you're going to age faster. There is a difference between chronological aging, so how many hours and minutes and years you've been alive on the planet, and biological aging, so how your body deteriorates, you know, with the time that you spend. So inflammation would increase the rate of biological aging. And aging is actually quite a diverse kind of process. So we don't, as an organism, age at the same rate. Different bits of our body will age faster than others, depending on the particular exposure that organism is experiencing. The second process is something called immunosenescence. So what that means is that as you get a bit older, the immune system starts to slow down, right? It starts to become slightly less effective. And what you want is a balance between the accelerator and the brake, right? You want to be chugging along that motorway, you know, it's sort of 60 miles an hour, maximally fuel efficient, not causing too much harm, but equally not going so slowly you're not getting anywhere. But so there's been lots of insight into how microbes change those two processes.
Mm.
And I'll give you one example of it. So there was a study done of some Japanese centenarians, which is kind of within the blue zone that you talked about in this particular, I think it was Osaka, I might be wrong on that, so forgive me if I am. But these populations have a very discrete set of bugs that influence the way that bile acid is metabolized. So bile acid is that green juice that we have within our guts that sometimes when you're sick you see. But bile acid is actually quite a sophisticated and important fluid that regulates lots of different processes within the body. And bugs are kind of important in its breakdown within the gut. So these particular bugs produce a very particular type of enzyme, and this bile acid has a very important anti-inflammatory effect, which seems to be really important in the aging process. And when you take that bug and you put it into an animal, those animals live longer, right? So you can engineer the microbiome to improve your risk of not just living a long life, but living a life that's a bit happier. If you go back, I mentioned Elie Metchnikoff, right, at the beginning when we were talking about immune system. So again, you can go back to his lecture. So he talked about this endlessly in the 1900s. And he was like, yeah, what you got to do is go to Bulgaria because they all live forever in Bulgaria. And that's because they take loads of probiotics. And that was his whole bag. And he thought the gut was a vestigial cesspool. And he thought that if you wanted to live a really long age, actually what you needed to do was never eat live or fresh foods, or, you know, never eat raw foods. And actually, there were even people around the early 1900s that advocated having your colon removed if you wanted to live a long life, right? Don't do that. That's really bad. So we've known that bugs are important in aging for a long time, is my point. They do have a critical component in describing how we should live a long and happy life. And they're very, very important explaining why we get some of the diseases of old age, right? And the thing that we are really interested in at the moment is things like Alzheimer's, you know, and memory loss as you get a bit older. Bugs are very, very important in that story. And we're going to see a lot more on that as we go forward.
Mm. Moving up then, I want to get to the lungs, but I want to just go to the mouth.
Yeah.
How important is chewing for our microbiome? And is there any link between not chewing properly and bowel cancer that you've seen?
So oral microbiome, fascinating, super important, and again, has gone through big evolutionary changes in a very short period of time because we brush our teeth and we have dental fillings, and these things change the microbiome. Microbiome in the mouth probably has, you know, an important part of, it's an important part of the story explaining why we kiss. So when you kiss someone, you share about 80 million microbes per kiss, right? And we know that actually that was an evolutionary thing because you're sharing bugs that have genes that allow you to break down foods and that might also have kind of health benefit. Microbes in your mouth influence the way you experience food. So they experience the way that you sense that food, so the way that you taste that food, because they create biofilms in the mouth, and they also break down some of these foods themselves that create chemical messengers. And they can also influence how you think about your appetite and how you feel about your sense of reward when you eat food. So oral microbiome, very, very important. Now, what we find is a lot of these bugs that live in the mouth turn up on a lot of different cancers or within cancers. So if we take my field, like bowel cancer, there's a particular bug called Fusobacterium nucleatum that commonly turns up in bowel cancers. Actually, it turns up in pancreatic cancers, cancers in the foregut and the stomach. It turns up even in breast cancers. And what we don't know is how or why. So we think that these bugs are probably getting there through the blood. And when they get into these cancers, they then change the behavior of those cancers. So what we find is those same oral bugs, in when cancer spreads, that process is called metastasis. So when cancer spreads out of the bowel and it goes to the liver, we find those bugs in those metastatic sites. So, and these are all quite commonly oral symbionts. So yeah, they're very, very important. Looking after your oral gut health is not just important for your dental hygiene, for your oral hygiene, but it's also important perhaps for the entire development of the body's microbiomes, and probably has implications that we don't really properly understand.
Interesting. Okay, so this is where we can get into the respiration a little bit now. One of the big things that I have gone deep down the rabbit hole of is mouth versus nose breathing. The nose does all these wonderful things, you know, filters the air, nasal nitric oxide, you know, pressurizes it, warms it, cools it, all that good stuff. Mouth doesn't tend to do a lot of that stuff. Mouth breathers and gut biome, anything that you've seen there?
Yeah. So what we know is that, so to take a step back, so the lung has its own microbiome. It's a very different microbiome to the gut because it's a low abundance system, which means that because you don't put food into it every day, if you do, that'd be really, really bad. There are far fewer microbes and there are far fewer types of microbes, but you inhale about 100 million viruses a day. You will have natural microscopic aspirations of saliva and things in your mouth into the lungs. And it absolutely has its own ecosystem. So what we know is that snorers or people who have sleep apnea have a very different lung microbiome to those that don't. We know that smokers kind of rather obviously have a very different lung microbiome to those that don't. Mm-hmm. And we know that particular bugs within the lung tend to be quite important in describing how you are, well, your risk of getting diseases or chronic diseases of the lung later in life. We also know that the lung microbiome and the gut microbiome are connected, and they are connected in quite meaningful ways. And they are connected, most importantly, through the immune system. So when you change the diversity or you change the structural function of the microbiome, or you become sick, that can affect how the lung works and vice versa, right? The two things happen. And smoking is a brilliant example of that. Like smoking causes systemic disease. Like you'll smoke a cigarette and it doesn't just cause lung disease and lung cancer and chronic obstructive airways disease. It changes your risk of bowel cancer. It changes your risk of chronic inflammatory diseases of the gut. It changes your risk of actually bladder cancer and a whole load of other systemic problems. And it changes the gut microbiome. So smokers have a different microbiome to gut microbiome to non-smokers. Now, there are confounders that might explain some of that, but even when you account for them, like different diet, different lifestyle, there's a kind of a definitive difference. So yeah, there's a very, very strong association. And I also believe that the nasal microbiome, particularly, was probably quite a big determinant of your risk of getting conditions like COVID. So if you've got like a really diverse and robust oropharyngeal microbiome, so bugs that live in the mouth, bugs that live in the nose, and there are actually very discrete niches of microbes within different components of these really important organs, that actually it's protective. It's protective against your risk of allergies. Now, in the top of this call, we were talking about hygiene hypothesis or oral hygiene hypothesis in the liver, right? So we can't talk about the lungs without talking about asthma, right? Or talk about chronic inflammatory conditions of the lung. So what we know is that the lung has really important barriers and the gut has really important barriers designed to keep bad bugs out. But those barriers are quite sophisticated living systems that they're not like, the Great Wall of the North, right? They're like a barrier reef. They have their own sort of living ecology that exists within those barriers. And a lot of the cells of our immune system exist within those barriers because that's the bit where the body communicates with the outside world, right? And that happens in the lung and it happens within the gut. And one of the theories is the destruction of those barriers over time that changes your risk of respiratory disease like asthma, because you change the way that particular cells within the immune system called T cells are educated and develop, and that changes your risk of asthma over time. So everything is connected is basically the message of what I'm trying to tell you. If you don't look after your gut, you can't have a healthy lung. If you don't look after your lung, you can't have a healthy gut. How you sleep, how you breathe, it's all important.
Yeah. How can we improve our nasal biome? Or maybe the other question is, how do we make it worse? What are we doing to make the nasal biome worse? Or is there a way we can enhance the flora in there, if that's the right term?
So again, I think a lot of that is kind of common sense. And you probably, frankly, talk about this on your podcast, on your channel a lot. So probably all of the things that you're saying are good things to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, top of the list is don't smoke, don't vape. Mm. So that you know, if you do those things, you cannot have a healthy nasal flora or pharyngeal microbiome. It will not be. And don't think that vaping is any better than smoking, because it really isn't. It's terrible. And I would strongly discourage it. I think there's some interesting new products coming to the market that will specifically target the nasal and the oral microbiome. So you're going to start to see nasal probiotic therapies and oral probiotic therapies coming on the market. But I think generally it's kind of just it's good sensible hygiene. What you don't want to be doing is putting too many things in your nose, because actually that disrupts the ecosystem that is there. I mean, what do you kind of advocate for your listeners?
Slow, gentle nasal breathing and a bit of humming. Yeah. Humming's been shown to release nasal nitric oxide, so we that's pretty much we keep it very, very simple. And I've recently come to understand that we shouldn't be spraying those decongestants upon those, really, because they seem to be terrible for us.
Yeah, I would totally go with that. Yeah. I mean, the other thing that I've got to say is, and this is kind of a harder one, but lose weight. Because again, when you're I appreciate that many people listening to this might be overweight and be thinking, well, look, I didn't choose to be overweight. And that's true. Right? And I also believe, by the way, that the microbiome has quite an important part to play in explaining that. But losing weight is not just so important for your health broadly and having a kind of normal BMI, but it also changes your airway. If you're overweight, you're going to have a shorter neck, and you're more likely to have sleep apnea. So you're more likely, when you sleep at night, not to be able to oxygenate appropriately, because basically your soft palate, the soft bit in the back of your mouth will just close down and you won't be able to breathe. That's why people who are overweight snore. So actually good sleep hygiene is a very, very important way to protect your microbiome. One really important way of having good sleep hygiene is by making sure that you've got, a sensible weight. So actually it comes all the way back to the beginning. It's about having a holistic approach to your healthcare that kind of promotes that intestinal or human microbiome diversity and balance. Like, I don't like the word balance. It's a bit of a sort of cop-out, I think. But at the same time, it's a nice way of communicating kind of what we really mean. Like, your lung microbiome is as important as your gut and vice versa. Think of them in a connected way.
Wonderful. As we draw it to a close, I've loved this. One question. Again, I listened to this anthropologist a lot called Dr. Chris Ryan, and he did a book called Civilized to Death, which is absolutely fascinating if you come across it. But he talks about how we should be looking at our poop. So should we be turning around looking at our poop? And if so, what should we be looking at or looking for?
Oh, yeah. So look, I'm a colorectal surgeon. So like, yeah, you 100% should. I mean, you should. Okay, look. I want to say two things. So first of all, yeah, you 100% should, because if you're noticing or experiencing a change in your bowel habit, right, or you're bleeding or you're passing too much mucus, go see your doctor, right? Forget the microbiome science. As a colorectal cancer surgeon, just don't be embarrassed. Go and get help. And of course, I think it's a bit kind of Victorian, isn't it? Looking at the consistency of your feces. But I've actually got a mate in Holland who's like a serious scientist at the university in Amsterdam. He's got this app that's got some AI algorithm that can, when you take a photo of your poo, it can then try and predict based on that image the likely kind of chemical content of your feces. So whether or not you believe that works, I don't know. But I think what I would say is that it probably is telling you something about the health of your diet and the health of your guts. If you're passing very liquid bowel motions all of the time, your gut function is not optimized. If you're very constipated all of the time, your gut function is not optimized. Now, some people are just born with slow guts, and the variation in bowel function is enormous. For some people, 3 times a day is normal. For others, once every 3 weeks is normal. Like, it's just hugely variable. But if you're symptomatic and you're having, you're not feeling like your gut is functioning normally, looking at kind of how you poo is kind of important. I just want to come back to like the whole, civilization thing. I think so I talk about something called the Anthropocene decline. So if you go back to 10,000 years ago, as human populations became really civilized, about 6,000 years ago, Stone Age man had kind of evolved quite a lot, and it started to live in cities. And Bronze Age man had, quite large-scale populations. And there was a Zhpilya culture, I think they were called, and they were out in kind of modern-day Ukraine and Moldova. Anyway, these populations grew quite large sizes. They had cities of about 20,000 people. And then they suddenly started to shrink, and everyone started to die. And no one really knew why, but of course, in time, we've come to conclude that it was probably the spread of pathogens that through these networks, probably things like Yersinia pestis, which is the cause of, the Black Death. And it was probably sweeping out Scandinavia and through Europe at that time. Anyway, I think what we're experiencing today is kind of an Anthropocene decline. So the Anthropocene is the current epoch that we live in, which basically describes we're shaping the world around us. The human existence is shaping the world around us, and it explains climate. And I think what's happening is a similar thing. Our populations our population sizes within urban environments has kind of hit maximum level. We have become obsessed by, the wrong things in our society. Like, we've become obsessed by wealth. We've become obsessed by owning, consumable or disposable products. We eat mass-produced food. We do all the same things that we're doing 6,000 years ago. And except this time, we're not dying. Because we are really good at creating medicines and vaccines, and we've got loads and loads of scientific knowledge. But what we are doing is we are not living happier, and we are now more likely to die of chronic diseases, and we are becoming more infertile. And we are starting to experience the limits of our kind of population growth. And so the solution to that has to be, let's just think a little bit more about how we protect our microbes. 6,000 years ago, they had to think about pathogens. today, you've got to think about symbionts. Like, how do we change the biodiversity of our planet to address the Anthropocene and to address the climate crisis we're experiencing? How do we address the biodiversity within us to promote our health so that we can all live longer and happier lives? And I think that has to be the main message.
Beautiful. That was a lovely way to end it. And thank you. And James, what one of my favorite conversations I've had, absolutely fascinated.
Oh, I'm so pleased.
Thank you so much.
I think
we're
going to talk for another hour.
I was going to say, I feel like let's do another one at some point, because I could keep going deeper with you on this, which is beautiful. So I'm going to link people to your book. Where would you like people to go next?
Well, is it Amazon? That's so kind of you. If you can come to dark-matter.org.uk, that would be great. And you can sign up there, and we're going to start producing some microbiome newsletters. And what we really want to do is to start doing some public microbiome projects. So we're going to launch all of these projects a bit later in the year. And if you go there and you sign up, you can keep in touch with me, and that would be awesome.
Beautiful. We will do that. So everybody, you know what you need to do next. Click on that link, go and get the book, go to the website, get registered. I hope to cross paths with you again in the future. Any last words you want to leave us with?
No, just thank you so much for having me. And it's a real treat to speak to you at length like that. And I love the work you do. Keep doing it.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thanks, everybody, for watching. Take care. Cheers.
Bye.
I hope you got something from this. At the start of this podcast, I asked, what would be one thing that you would do differently listening to all this? So there's probably 50 things that you've got from this densely packed podcast, but what's one thing? And I was just thinking, like, what's my one thing here? I think what I'm going to be doing here is increasing my fiber, I think, is what I need to look at first. That's the one takeaway that I've got from this. I hope you enjoyed the Dark Matter podcast. I'm going to get him back again. That's my goal as well, because I could just talk to this guy for hours. Have a wonderful rest of your day. Now, what do you do next if you're on YouTube? You can click here, and you can watch this breathing exercise, which I highly recommend. Or if you like this poop one, maybe you're going to be interested in this podcast here. So you could click here and watch this one. Thank you so much for being with us. Take a deep breath. And I'll see you in one of these next videos. Cheers.